great to be back with you. Look to see you all again. And I just want to start, you'll understand why in a moment, by telling you just a tiny bit about my background. And my parents were very committed Christians, the elders in our church. My mum was deeply involved in the church life as well. And they brought me up very much. They shaped much of what I am and taught me to love God and to love the Word. And I'm sure that those of us who are parents will want to do the same thing for our children, but it goes back more generations than that. My grandmother lived with us for many years before she died about 15-20 years ago, and my a couple of memories of my grandmother when her eyesight got to be too bad to read a Bible. She didn't stop reading a Bible. She just got herself a large print Bible so she could keep on reading it. And when she struggled with a large print Bible, she discovered that if she went out into the conservatory and sat where the light was really good, then she could still read it, even though a bit more slowly. And I know loads of Welsh hymns because of my grandmother. I don't know what any of the words mean, right? But, you know, I can quite happily sing things like Ye Bob Een Sin Fuddlen or whatever, you know, because I can remember my grandmother singing them as she potted about the house. And on the other side of the family, my dad was brought up by his parents to love God, and my grandmother and grandfather, they had quite a large house in the Neath Valley, and it seemed that whenever I visited them, then there was some missionary who'd sort of taken over half the house and was living there temporarily while they were back on back home in the UK, and then my grandmother's mother was from Plymouth, one of the original Plymouth Brethren, shall I say, and she was known for her hospitality and the. Many times in my life, I sort of found sort of people from a generation which is but largely passed on now who would come to me and say, back in the war when I was stationed in Plymouth, your grandmother, or great-grandmother actually, took me under a wing and looked after me when I was away from home and gave me food when I ran out of rations and so on. So that's, you know, a bit of where I come from. But here's a question for you. Am I here this morning because I've got this great heritage, you know, and I thank God for the heritage I've got, but does it qualify me in some special way to be a preacher, a teacher of the Word of God? Or are there other things that qualify? And you might think you know the answer to that, but let's look at an example and see what the Bible says about it, and we'll come back to that. But we're going to go completely away from that. And first of all, you might wonder where I'm going, but don't worry, we'll come back to this question. And I want to take you back to the Bronze Age. So we're talking maybe 3,500 years ago. And a world that at face value might seem very different from ours. And the place that we're at in the Bronze Age is the ancient city of Jericho. So it's a part to the Dead Sea. And we're close, but not quite on the banks of the River Jordan, one of the lowest points on the Earth's crust, about 600 foot below sea level. So here we are in the Bronze Age in this ancient place. And you might think that this ancient city has really got very little to do with us. But you know, Jericho at this time had already been a city for thousands of years, so the archaeologists will tell us, which is more than you can say for Cardiff. And they had a sophisticated, complex civilization. And this city of Jericho, we know from archaeology, was linked to the great empires of the world at that time. So they traded with Egypt down to the south. They traded to Babylon in the east. They traded with the Hittites in Turkey in the north. And they traded with the emerging Greek Empire across the sea. They were connected to the world, even though this is back in the Bronze Age. And it was a rich community. The economy was based around bitumen and salt. Plenty of salt in the Dead Sea, which was a scarce commodity in those days, and they exported it. And they traded it for luxury goods from other parts of the world. And bitumen, which bubbles up out of the ground in a few places in the desert, that could be used for sealing baskets and making things waterproof and so on. Another valuable commodity, and they exported that, and they got lots of money for it. So it was a rich city. And for that reason, then they had strong walls around it to try and protect their wealth and protect themselves. And although the city was in the desert, there were powerful springs there that allowed them to irrigate their fields and grow crops. And so, even though we're in the Bronze Age and we're 3,500 years ago, then in many ways we would have recognized what went on in life. You know, these people were not like sort of some kind of primitive savages who we can't relate to in any way. And if you'd walked around ancient Jericho, you'd have found smiths working in their smithies, making everything from hairpins to frying pans. And you'd have found market traders selling exotic goods that had been brought in from the east and the north and the west and the south. And you'd have found the farmers going out and ploughing their fields and planting their fields and watering their crops. And the food they ate, they grew barley and wheat, so that meant they had beer and bread. Very good, you might say. What more does a man need in life than beer and bread? But they ate things like olives and leeks and garlic and grapes, the kind of stuff you find in the supermarket. They ate and they had in their market stores. And life just went on. But life was very different in one important respect. If you like, the dark shadow over over Jericho was around their religion. And they worshipped a Canaanite god called Asherah. And Asherah was a goddess of fertility. And if you allow your imagination to run riot and think about how people might worship a goddess of fertility, then your imagination probably doesn't quite get the full extent of the way they worshipped them. But we won't go into those details. And when Asherah was angry with them, they thought the best way of dealing with Asherah's anger was to sacrifice the children. So child sacrifice was compromised. So you've already got this picture now in your mind of this ancient city in the desert, next to the string, next to the springs, next to the river, next to the sea, rich and planned. And just across the river, at the time of our story, just across the river Jordan, is a huge camp of nomadic Israelites who have turned up from the desert. And rumours about them, and rumours about their success in battle, have gone ahead of them. And there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of Israelites camped across the river, and nobody in Jericho quite knows what they're there for. And that's where we pick up our story. And I'll read it to you, or you can follow it for yourselves if you want to, in Joshua chapter 2. And Joshua chapter 2, at the beginning of the chapter, says this: "And Joshua, son of Nun, secretly sent two spies from Shittim." So Joshua was one of these Israelites camped across the river from our town of Jericho. "Go look over the land," he said, "especially Jericho." So they went and entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab and stayed there. And the king of Jericho was told, "Look, some of the Israelites have come tonight to spy out the land." So the king of Jericho sent this message to Rahab: "Bring out the men who came to you and entered your house, because they've come to spy out the whole land." But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. And she said, "Yes, the men came to me, but I didn't know where they'd come from. At dusk, when it was time to close the city gate, the men left. I don't know which way they went. Go after them quickly. You might catch up with them." But she'd actually taken them up onto the roof and hidden them under the stalks of flax she'd laid out on the roof. So the men set out in pursuit of the spies on the road that leads to the fords of Jordan. And as soon as the pursuers had gone, the gate was shut. Right, let's tell that story. So Rahab, she was an innkeeper, shall we say. An innkeeper who offered some value-added services. And her name means broad. And the word broad, the meaning is exactly the same as the word in English. I mean, when it's applied in a pejorative sense to women. And so Rahab, this innkeeper, this prostitute, she two strangers come to her, two strange men. Now, nothing unusual about that, you might say. And these two men are here to try and spy out Jericho on behalf of the Israelites who are camped across the river. And of course, you know, staying in an inn, you know, the kind of place where lots of blokes go in and out, is a great place for spies to hide. And when they were there, there must have been something about these two men that was different from her other customers. Perhaps they didn't want her value-added services. And presumably they talked to Rahab about their God. They talked to her about the miracles that he conducted, about how he'd been looking after them in the desert, feeding them miraculously, rescued them from the hands of the Egyptians. But when the men are in Rahab's inn, then the king of Jericho gets a little bit suspicious, and he hears rumors that there are Israelites who are staying with Israel. So he sends his soldiers out to try and find the men, and presumably to torture them and to extract all sorts of stories from them about what the plans of the Israelites are for. And Rahab, rather than handing these two men over to her king, to the soldiers of her own country, rather than handing these spies over, she tells them to go up onto the roof and to hide there. Now, it just says in the Bible that she hid them under some stalks of flax that were drying. And you think, well, why on earth were these soldiers, men, not found under stalks of drying flax? Well, the reason is that flax is used to make linen. So if you've got any linen clothes, then that's the fibers are extracted from flax. And the process for making linen from flax is you take the flax and you dump the flax into a stagnant pond. It's got to be a stagnant pond because there's lots of bacteria in a stagnant pond. And gradually the linen starts to, or the flax starts to rot. And the trick is to take the flax back out of the pond after all the soft tissue of the flax has rotted, but the fibers haven't rotted. So she'd obviously been at this stage where this stuff had been rotting for about 2 weeks in a stagnant pond. And she'd taken it out to lay it on the roof of the house. And it must have stunk, right? You could probably smell it halfway across the city. And so these soldiers, there's no way that they would have wanted to go and investigate what looked like a bacteria-filled compost heap, sort of full of revolting, smelly flax. And so the men hide under there. The soldiers don't bother looking. And Rahab says, they went that way. And the men go running off after where she points. And so when the soldiers are gone and the city gates are closed for the night, then Rahab says, well, look, you know, my inn, it's got a window overlooking, it's built into the city walls, it overlooks the walls. And so she gives them a rope and they clamber out of the window and down to the rope and escape in the night and hide in the hills for a couple of days. And the rest of the story is well known if you've ever been to Sunday school. Joshua and the Battle of Jericho. And eventually the Israelites cross the River Jordan in a miraculous way, and they go into battle against Jericho. And everyone from the city of Jericho is killed as part of that battle, except for Rahab, because the spies had struck a deal with her that if she kept a red cord hanging out of her window, the window overlooking the city walls, if she kept a red cord hanging out of the window, then the Israelites would spare her. And they kept their promise. So Rahab was saved. And that is the end of the story. We don't hear any more mention of Rahab anywhere else in the book of Joshua or Judges or any of the subsequent books in the Old Testament. History draws a veil. But before we go back and ask a couple more sort of questions before we go back and to our original question about sort of families and whether I'm here because of my family, then let's just pick up a little question from this story about Rahab. And it's about telling the truth. There was a great band back in the 1990s, if any of you remember the Britpop era, and there was a band called Republica, and they sang this song, and it was a female band to make sense of the lyrics, and the lyrics went like this: I know that my ex-boyfriend lies. He does it all the time. It's just his permanent disguise. Yeah, but he's drop dead gorgeous. And when I look at you, you're forgiven. Right, so according to Republica, then it's okay to lie if you've got a bit of sex appeal, right? If you're good looking, then you can be forgiven for telling lies, which sounds a little bit shallow, but hey, it's a good song anyway. Now, Rahab, clearly by her profession, had sex appeal. Does that excuse her lying? Well, no, does it? right? But does anything, right? She told a massive, great lie, hadn't she, right? You know, she was asked, where are these two men? And she said they went that way when actually they were hiding up on the roof. Did she do the right thing? And you know what? If you kind of try Googling to find out whether or not people think that Rahab did the right thing when she told this massive lie, then you find that there's actually a raging theological argument that has gone on for centuries, right? There's one American professor in a Bible school in America says that there are few subjects that ignite his seminary classes like this one. And, you know, I think the earliest record that we've got of somebody weighing up the rights and wrongs of it was Augustine, who was writing in the 4th century. And Augustine, St. Augustine, said that it was never morally permissible to lie. He thought that Rahab had done the wrong thing. But other theologians differ. Bonhoeffer, the German theologian who spent much of his time trying to save Jews from the Nazis and eventually was brutally hung. He was killed by being hung by piano wire in a German concentration camp shortly before the end of the war. And Bonhoeffer said that truth sometimes conflicts with other moral obligations. And so he lied to protect innocence. When the Nazis asked him where the Jews were, he told lies. He thought it was the right thing to do to protect people. He thought that there were other moral obligations that were of greater importance on occasions. Well, we're probably not going to get fully to the bottom of a complicated debate like this. What I'd say is this, you know, understand that Rahab, as this very young believer in the Lord, right? She'd heard what the spies had told her and clearly believed what the spies had told her about their God. She's able to quite deftly deal with a very complex theological issue when put on the spot, the spur of the moment, when asked a question. And she had competing moral objectives. Should she save the lives of the spies, who she believed were God's chosen people? Or should she uphold her duty of hospitality to her guests? Or should she tell the truth? And for me, James in the New Testament settles the question. Because Rahab is mentioned a couple of times in the New Testament. I said she wasn't mentioned again in the Old Testament. She mentioned in the New Testament. And James addresses this question. He says, wasn't even Rahab the prostitute considered righteous for what she did when she gave lodging to the spies and sent them off in a different direction? There you go. James says that Rahab was considered righteous for misleading the king's soldiers and sending them off in another direction. And the writer to Hebrews says something similar. By faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. Now, most of us will never find ourselves in a situation where, you know, we've got moral objectives competing at that level. So don't use that as an excuse to go out and be dishonest. Right? Don't misunderstand me. But very, very rarely, then there may be a time when it's the right thing to do. And Rahab did the right thing. And there's something remarkable going on here. Right, Rahab, she's this pagan, a Canaanite pagan worshipper of the fertility goddess Asherah. She might even have been involved in the sacrifice of children. And a woman who had a lifestyle choice that we can perhaps best describe as questionable. And she's a brand new believer in the Lord. And she cuts through the seminary debates and acts in faith to do the right thing. And I think that's amazing. And we'll come back to it in a moment. But before we do, there's one more mention of Rahab in the Bible. And it comes right at the beginning of the New Testament. Now, the New Testament begins in quite a dull way, I'm afraid to say. You know, I don't like to say the Bible's dull, but you know what I mean. The New Testament begins in quite a dull way because it starts off with just a list of names. And if those names don't mean anything to you, then they're probably not very inspiring. So let me read the start of the New Testament. It goes like this. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Okay? And at this point, I know what it's like, right? You're reading your Bible and your eyes are glazing over and you're starting to yawn already because it's going to be a list of names. You know it's going to be a list of names. And you probably just like skip straight to the bottom. But bear with me. We're going to read this list of names. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, Judah the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar, Perez the father of Hezron, Hezron the father of Ram, Ram the father of Aminadab, Aminadab the father of Nahshon, Nahshon the father of Salmon, Salmon the father who's Boaz. Wait a minute, right, listen to this next sentence, right, because you've probably already switched off, whose mother was Rahab, right, Rahab, this prostitute from Jericho suddenly appears in the genealogy of Jesus. She also appears in the genealogy of King David. Extraordinary. There were only four women who were mentioned in Jesus' genealogy, and I think that people have suggested that they're all singled out because they were all Gentiles, right? By definition, Jesus was a Jew, so his father's father, and so on. They were all Jews, and we know lots of the women who are in Jesus' genealogy, but the ones who are mentioned in Matthew appear to be all ones who were probably, there's a bit of doubt about one of them, but probably the ones who were all Gentiles. And so we find that the New Testament starts off by saying that our Lord was descended from Rahab, this Canaanite prostitute. But before we go on a little bit further, we know her partner. We know that she was married to Salmon. Or Salmon. I'll say his name exactly. So who was he? Well, you can go digging with your concordance in the Old Testament and try and find it. And another genealogy in the Old Testament tells us who this man Salmon was, who Rahab married. And Salmon was a prince. He was, his father was the leader of the tribe of Judah. So there were 12 tribes in Israel, and so there were 12 leaders of the tribes, and Salmon, who Rahab married, was the son of one of those the leaders of the tribe. He was possibly, right, I mean, I don't know who else was unmarried at this time, but it's quite possible that at the time that Rahab married him, that Salmon was the most eligible bachelor in the whole of the nation of Israel. Why on earth would he choose to marry Rahab with a questionable past? I mean, you know, the most eligible bachelor in the land marrying a prostitute. And some people don't like that this woman Rahab is sat in Jesus and David's genealogy. But God is trying to teach us something by revealing this connection with Jesus himself. What is he teaching us? My opening question was this, wasn't it? I told you a bit about myself and said, am I uniquely qualified to preach and teach in this church because of my genealogy, because of my Christian roots, because my great-grandmother lived in Plymouth and was a member of the Brethren, so for a really solid Plymouth Brethren person. Right, now Paul asked this question too. And Paul came back and he said, no, right, no. No, 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 1,000 no's, right? Your family history does not give you any extra qualifications in the church. And this story that we've got of Rahab tells us that in God's world, some really dodgy characters can be fully accepted and accepted into the highest place, right? Can marry a prince and become a forefather of the greatest king that the land has had, and a forefather of Jesus the Messiah himself. And so this story of Rahab, to close, gives us two lessons. And the first lesson for me is this. It's about the status of new converts in the church. You know, the church, a healthy church, will always have some people in it who haven't been Christians for a long time. And I think that people who weren't like me, so brought up by Christian parents. But do you ever worry? And I'm not saying these things happen in your church, but these are things that I've observed happening in places. And do you ever worry that in the church things like this happen? Do you worry that Christians from established families like mine might have an unspoken higher status in the church? Do you ever worry that Christians with the right upbringing are more likely to be trusted with responsibility in the church? Do you ever worry that Christians with whom we grew up are closer to the church's inner circle, the inner social circles? Do you ever worry that children from Christian families might be treated differently in our youth work? Do you ever worry that spiritual wisdom from new believers, like Rahab, is afforded less respect than spiritual wisdom from those who've been around for a long time? Do you ever worry that sometimes we assume that people with the right history are better place to pray for us than new believers? Or better place to heal us or teach us? Do you ever worry that we might be more sensitive to the wants and needs of established Christians when we're trying to work out our church programs than those of new converts? Do you ever worry that we might unconsciously regard ourselves as better Christians because of our upbringing? And I suppose you can wrap all that up by one broader worry. Do you ever worry that we might be becoming a hereditary church? Because if that's what's happening, the story of Rahab teaches us that we shouldn't be like that. These things should not be so. You know, this young woman, this new convert, this woman with such a questionable lifestyle, she was someone who was able to do the work of God and be fully integrated into the story of the Bible. So that's my first question, is how do we treat young Christians and those who are not from the established families of the church? But there's another question. One of our themes for the year in Eden Church, where I come from, is that we as Christians should be disciples who make disciples. That's great. That's what Jesus is teaching. And this idea of being disciples who make disciples throws out two questions. One question is, who are you discipling? And the other question is, who's discipling me? And when we start asking those questions of ourselves, then I think that the natural place that we go to is to assume that those of us who are established Christians need to find some new convert to disciple, and that the new converts really haven't got anyone to disciple because there's no one kind of more junior than them, if you like. And in reflecting on Rahab, I've realized that kind of like my assumption about who can disciple me, who can teach me, is incomplete. Because Rahab shows us that a new believer can have greater spiritual discernment in her choice of how to deal with the questions thrown at her by the soldiers. A new believer can have greater discernment than a seminary college full of theological students who just want to talk about the issue, whereas she did the right thing. And new believers and returning believers who've been away from the Lord for a time have experiences and wisdom from situations that established Christians, like myself, just never encounter. And in looking at a story like Rahab, I've realized that for myself, I need to learn more from the young Christians that we've got in Eden and to listen more to them. And I found it quite enlightening as this kind of penny has dropped. And I've talked to friends who are new converts and to hear their experiences. And I learn things from them that I'm sorry if you're an established Christian that perhaps you could never have told me because they've got different experiences from what you have. Now, what I'd say is this: God doesn't limit his grace to those who are long in the spiritual tough. And passion and godly fire and the presence of God are actually not very strongly correlated with how long you've been a Christian or what kind of family you come from. So two questions. Are we becoming a hereditary church? How do you treat and respect those who are new to the faith? And the second question is, what can you learn from those who are new in faith? And I'll leave you with a final thought, which came from Paul. Paul was saying, look, I have got pedigree, right? Trust me, I've got pedigree. If I was a dog, I'd be in Crufts, right? You know, I've got it, right? My history is right. And this is what he says. I myself have reasons for such confidence in my family background. If someone else thinks they've got reasons to put confidence in the flesh, I've got more, right? I was circumcised on the eighth day of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, in regard to the law, a Pharisee. As for zeal, persecuting the church. As for righteousness based on the law, faultless, right? My pedigree is perfect, says Paul. But whatever were gains to me, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. It doesn't matter, right? You know, our pedigree doesn't count.